Now, In Depth with Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening on Friday, September 11th, 2015. It is the Federal News Countdown. The three most important federal news stories of the week is selected by two experts in the world of the federal government. This week, expert number one is Tim Young of Deloitte. It is great to see you, my friend. How are you?
Great. Great to be here, especially on this day.
And I have a question for you. I noticed in the email that you sent me when you sent me your story list that your signature now says Deloitte Digital. What does that mean?
So I now lead our Deloitte Digital practice. It's a digital agency within a large consulting firm.
Yeah.
It's been a very inspiring year for me.
Okay, and I just realized after I asked you that it turned into a commercial, which I didn't intend, but I just noted that difference since the last time you and I had corresponded.
Yeah.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Roger Baker is my other expert in the world of federal government and the Federal News Countdown, and I have on my list here that you are a Roger Baker free agent. Is that correct?
Roger Baker Consulting, LLC.
Okay, that's a pretty clever name that you got there.
Well, you know, it's a good brand name.
Must have taken moments to figure out that brand name.
It was available. It's a Florida corporation, so it was available.
Okay, well, congratulations on that. And what kind of stuff are you doing?
Just advisory consulting stuff. It's kind of fun. I don't do much work, and that's probably my favorite part.
I note here that my definition of that is anything anyone will pay you for.
No, absolutely not.
Oh, okay, good.
Only what I want to do, and if they'll pay me well.
Okay, terrific. Well, I can't argue with the logic there.
I'm an old guy, you know. I can just, you know, I'm cranky at this point.
You're not old. Well, cranky, yes. That I can vouch for.
It's not the age that matters. It's the mileage.
There you go.
I don't even want to get into that. I just had my 50th birthday a couple of weeks ago, so I'm feeling all of that, Tim. So now you've made me feel really old and crusty.
My apologies.
Thanks for launching the show on a wonderful note. Hey, we'll start where we always do on the Federal News Countdown with...
Number three!
And Roger, your choice says the third most important federal news story of the week is from the Federal Times. The headline is Six Things to Know If the Government Shuts Down. Now, I have a commentary on federalnewsradio.com saying that I think the probability is about 25%. But my takeaway is that feeds actually what you're writing about here, because if it's not likely that there's a shutdown, then everybody's really wasted a whole lot of time in the past several weeks and in the weeks to come.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And this happens regularly. You know, somewhere around 21 days before the end of an appropriation, the folks inside the agencies have to start a clock and start doing everything that is just due diligence, whether they shut down or not. You know, in effect, you know, they're screaming towards a brick wall at 90 miles an hour. And at some point, somebody says, you know, it'd be a really good idea if we understood whether the brakes work or not. We don't have to put them on yet. We better test the brakes. We better do everything necessary to make sure that we can stop. And so if you think about it, who's going to start down that path first? It's the most senior executives in an organization that have to start planning for that to occur. Well, you know, take my old agency, Veterans Affairs. I'm telling you, those senior executives have more productive things that they could be doing right now to serve veterans than figuring out how to shut the agency down if it happens or if it doesn't. And especially if they go through this every 60 days, every 30 days, replanning a shutdown. You know, eventually the window gets a little bit shorter and a little bit shorter as they plan it out, but they're going to waste an enormous amount of energy that should be applied elsewhere in figuring out how to deal with a shutdown. Mm-hmm. And I thought this article was very, very good from that standpoint. Here we are on September 11th, you know, 19 days from when a shutdown might happen, and they're already thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. And have already started to plan for it. I've had a number of conversations with people who went through the 2013 shutdown, and those are archived at federalnewsradio.com to talk about, Tim, the things that people should be thinking about, maybe things that didn't happen in 2013 but should have. And it seems to me your old agency, OMB, is probably just pulling their hair out right about now.
Yeah, I mean, this article, more than most that I've seen in recent days, speaks to the need to hope for the best but plan for the worst. I think my personal view is, you know, hope is not a great strategy, but I agree with Roger. Senior executives have to plan for this because of the unpredictability of what's going to happen in Congress. I think the underlying tone and significance of this article is the need for our people to hold our congressmen and women accountable for doing their jobs. I can't remember a time during my tenure in D.C., which is almost 20 years now, where we had a full appropriations enacted for every single agency.
Yeah,
I don't think it happened during my tenure in the Bush administration.
Yeah.
And it hasn't happened since then. It was probably the Clinton administration.
And if an agency failed to do their job that thoroughly, imagine the hearings that would be going on. The beatings on the Hill would be unmerciful, because this is complete failure to do your fundamental job.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Agreed.
The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Roger Baker from the Federal Times. Six things to know if the government shuts down. Tim, your choice at number three is my colleague Emily Kopp's story, Veterans Affairs' new customer service credo, make employees happy. Tom Allen, the new executive at VA, is undertaking here, it sounds to me, what every single HR person that I've talked to in the past year has said about engaging federal employees and helping them understand what the importance of the mission is, and trying to get them to understand, essentially, we care about you and we want your experience to be good.
Yeah, so I really like this article because it shifts the focus from viewing a customer as the buyer to customer as the employee. Right. And so if you look at the spectrum of customer from retail to regulator, retail being how GSA views its customers, regulator how the SEC, FDIC view its customers, this article speaks to the importance of moving from focusing on customer service to focusing on customer delight in using your employees as enablers of your mission, which is a refreshing shift in the focus. And so I really like this article because it highlighted some of the goodness of government and what can be what the art of the possible is when you apply a fairly seasoned and accomplished senior executive from the private sector to a government challenge, and you put a lot of executive support behind that.
I imagine this article and this concept spoke to you, Roger, given this is your old stomping grounds.
Yeah, and I love what Tom Allen's trying to do. I love the fact that he came into government with this kind of experience, said, hey, Bob, can I come and help you? By the way, I used his official title, Bob, instead of Secretary of Veterans Affairs. Mm-hmm. Here's the quandary I have with this one. What he's trying to tackle is such a huge problem. And the other thing is to recognize that what he's trying to do, which is to really help employee morale, has 10 different things in government that are built to frustrate what he's trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
The personnel system, the management system, Congress talking about, we ought to be able to fire anybody anytime.
Promoting and incentives, all of that stuff.
All those things are wrapped around a system that really isn't designed to value the employee. It's designed to treat everybody exactly fairly, and that means badly.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what Tom is trying to do is completely change a fundamental way of operating inside the federal government. I just think everybody needs to recognize that, so that in 3 years when they say, well, he only had, so much impact. If you lean against Mount Everest for 2 years and it moves an inch, you really did something.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what Tom's trying to do here.
And his strategy for making the change, I think, is one that a lot of agencies can learn from, because he's not trying to tackle the entire department all at once.
Yeah.
Actually, one of the taglines of the article is progress will happen facility by facility, right? And that is a infectious way to impart change when you can have impact on a facility, highlight those changes. Most people, certainly during my tenure in government, I wanted to be associated with positive change, right? And so if there was something that had motivation, I was more likely to be attracted to that than otherwise. And so I think this strategy will pay off. I agree with you, Roger. I think it'll take time, but very, very positive news for the government.
And I just want to say, having worked with these folks at VA, you will not find more dedicated people to the mission that they're doing. They get an undue slam as employees. 98 to 99% of them are just incredible, dedicated, doing everything they can for the veteran. The system frustrates them, and if Tom can fix that, more power to him.
The third most important federal news story of the week is selected by Tim Young, is from federalnewsradio.com, Veterans Affairs' new customer service credo, make employees happy. You can find that story and all of our stories on this week's Federal News Countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the second most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Tim Young and Roger Baker on In Depth with Francis Rose. Be right back. Welcome back to the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose. The three most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Roger Baker and Tim Young And we are up to
number two.
Roger, your choice at number two is from federalnewsradio.com. It's Jason Miller's story titled, Rep. Hurd, Congressman Hurd, puts CIOs on notice about FITARA implementation. Congressman Will Hurd is chairman of the Subcommittee on Information Technology, the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee, and he is promising this week to look at how agencies are implementing FITARA. Congressman Jerry Connolly, who was one of the authors and co-sponsors of FITARA, is very pleased so far at what he's seeing from the Office of Management and Budget as far as guidance for implementing FITARA and what the expectations will be that OMB will have for agencies to comply with the provisions of the law. What do you think so far about what you're seeing, and what do you think about the effort of Congressman Hurd, Chairman Hurd, to look at how agencies are going to implement this law?
So I like the fact that Chairman Hurd is weighing in on it. I'm hoping that he's really not serious that he's putting CIOs on notice, that that's the headline side, because it really isn't the CIOs that have to implement the real changes in FITARA. I mean, it really is going to be at the cabinet level, you know, that these things have to occur. There has to be buy-in. You know, I'm a proponent of a very, very aggressive approach to FITARA. You know, I think a lot of things that we're trying to emulate across government have been modeled out at VA at this point. And you can look at good and bad from a, you know, from VA IT implementation, but the fact is that that agency has gone a long ways forward under the consolidated IT that it would not have done had that consolidation not occurred. And so I'd like to see OMB step in a lot harder on this. You know, my advocacy has been that OMB should say, if you implement this well, your budget goes through easily. If you implement this poorly, we'll take 20% off your IT budget. Now, which would you like to do, implement it well or implement it poorly? That's where OMB has the power. And so I like seeing these folks get in and say, we're serious this time. We're going to make changes. There's a reason why federal IT lags behind the private sector. And this is not all of it, but it's a significant portion of it. The ability to have people that are willing to make decisions and take risks. You know, sometimes they're going to pan out well, sometimes they're going to pan out poorly. But I assure you, if you don't take risks in IT, then you're going to look a lot like what federal IT looks like right now.
To Roger's point, Tim, Congressman Hurd says, we're coming up with a FITARA scorecard so Congress uses its oversight role to ensure these agencies are implementing FITARA the way they're supposed to. But you can infer from that CIOs will have some expectations and that Congress will be watching them. It strikes me that might be on purpose, though Roger doesn't like that idea. The idea may be we're going to put pressure on these CIOs and see which ones can take it. And if there are some that are not up to the job and don't feel that this fits with their skill set, then maybe we'll wind up with some different CIOs.
Yeah, I think, generally speaking, the scorecard approach, I think, has shown promise. During my tenure in the government, the President's Management Agenda Scorecard, red, yellow, green, how are you performing? A lot of transparency. I think move the needle on results. But to Roger's point, I think the more enduring approach is to tie this to budget, right? Because certain individuals in government are motivated based on what they get credit for or how they get exposed. But almost every single person I know in government, whether they're a civil servant or a political appointee, is motivated based on access to budget or the threat of decreased budget. And so I agree that Congress needs to play a role on the authorizing side with a scorecard approach. But in my view, the Appropriations Committee needs to also be part of that conversation to hold not just CIOs, but deputy secretaries accountable for implementing the provisions of FITARA. I think that the principles of FITARA are very sound. The question I have is, how is it going to be evenly implemented across all the agencies, and what is OMB going to do to make sure that there is some consistency to the way in which it's implemented? And we had, during my tenure in government, we had a very simple equation that I think could be emulated across government, which is providing transparency to performance gives you clarity of progress or not. Providing clarity provides the opportunity to hold people personally accountable, and providing personal accountability gives you enduring results. It's a very simple equation, but I think it holds true today.
Just have a minute or so left on this story, Roger. I don't mean to imply that I think the idea of a stress test on CIOs to encourage them to move on if they're not up to it is implied here. And I don't also mean to suggest that I think it's a good idea. I am simply reflecting the fact that I'm hearing a little bit from the Hill, and in some cases from the CIO community, that it could be an unintended consequence of a focus on chief information officers in FITARA execution.
Yeah. And it is a big boys and girls game. You know, these are very, very senior folks. By and large, the folks that I know in those roles would survive on this stuff. As I just go through and think of faces and names, these folks are going to do pretty well.
Yep.
You know, the cadre of folks right now serving as CIOs, I think will do fine. The key thing about this is getting them the management support that allows them to take those risks, that really let them get out there and excel as IT professionals.
Roger Baker's choice at number two on the Federal News Countdown. Congressman Hurd put CIOs on notice about FITARA implementation. And that story is archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Tim Young's choice at number two this week is, you threw me a little bit of a curveball here, my friend. This is from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Sloan Management Review, and it is titled "The Talent Imperative in Digital Business." What do you got here for me, my friend?
So the reason I chose this particular article is a trend that I'm observing in federal and state and local government, where organizations are moving from toe-dipping on digital to going all in on digital and making their organizations digitally enabled, because it serves as a talent magnet to attract and, more importantly, to retain top talent, because they're providing experiences on the job and access to tools and technology that those individuals, those colleagues, experience in their private life, right? And that is the expectation of not only millennials, but people in my generation and above, like actually both of you, if I could just put
that was the end above, wasn't it?
Yes, yeah. It was.
He had to throw that out.
So the reason
you remember, I determine who gets invited on this program, by the way.
This is true. You can always censor me. So the trend that I'm observing, though, frankly, is a lot of agencies embracing digital as a way of doing business, not as a fad. So mobile only. Not mobile first, right? Think of Uber, mobile only, right? And a lot of agencies are now investing in this with a level of scale that is frankly refreshing. I mean, you look at U.S. Digital Services out of the White House, 18F, my own personal organization with Deloitte Digital. I mean, this is a trend that I think will endure, not because it's the right thing to do, but because it is employee led and demanded.
I'm going to put words in your mouth, and you can tell me that I'm wrong if I'm wrong, but I'm going to guess that you're jealous of the efforts that are happening in government now because you didn't have access to them or didn't have as much access to them as agencies do now when you were in, Roger.
Actually, I see it as an evolution.
Mm-hmm.
The benefit of being an old guy, Tim.
as we seem to be in the eyes of Tim Young.
Yeah, I look at, I look at things like how in vogue Google employees are right now. And it really speaks to what Tim's, you know, what this article is, which is, you know, there's a geek chic. And, you know, being an employee of something that is that highly successful and being perceived as somebody whose career has been launched along those ways is really, really valuable for folks. It's fun. It's good for you from a career standpoint. It's good from a social standpoint. It's, you know, good a long, long ways around. You know, what's interesting to me is back in 94 and 95, I was at Visa, and we were hiring engineers to do internet banking during that period of time, and we were hiring them in Northern Virginia. We could hire anybody we wanted to hire, and we didn't have to pay anymore because we weren't doing federal work. We were doing, you know, banking and internet, and it was easy to hire the best people for exactly that reason. You know, those folks want to go to work for an organization that they perceive as cutting edge, good for their career, fun to work at, and leveraging what the next thing is, whatever it is. And so this is absolutely a spot on article. Getting the federal government to do it, that is a difficult thing.
Tim, I can't read the title of this article for the folks because my reading glasses are laying over next to my cane and I can't reach them. So this is the second most important story you chose is what?
If you want to borrow my trifocals,
no.
You can. The title is The Talent Imperative in Digital Business.
Oh, right. It's from the MIT thing. Thank you very much for that. And the second most important federal news story of the week, and all of our stories, archived at federalnewsradio.com. It's on that cool thing called the internets that the kids are using. And when we come back, the most important federal news stories of the week on the Federal News Countdown. Welcome back to In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio. This week's Federal News Countdown features the three most important federal news stories of the week, as selected by Tim Young and Roger Baker, and we're up to
number one.
And Roger, your choice is the most important federal news story of the week is from the Washington Post. The headline is "Lawmakers Require Ex-Clinton Staffer Who Worked on Email Server to Appear." And you know that although I'm interested in political stuff, we don't really talk about that on the show. So the idea of how all of this affects the presidential race is not of great interest to me. I don't care about that. The mechanics of it I find fascinating. The idea that, forget who it was, the idea that a senior leader at a federal agency could say, I'm going to do this over here in this particular way, when general policy is a totally different thing, is what I'm paying attention to. And now the complication here of how this affects other people who were either asked or told to do certain things in a certain way is the wrinkle that it appears is coming out in the story that you've selected.
Yeah, and I really selected this one because of the overall trend for the last couple of years. You know, being a back closet IT guy is not a safe protection from, you know, the scorching politics of Washington at this point. Henry Chow saw that at HHS and other folks, you know, with the healthcare.gov. You know, if there is a hot political issue and folks believe they can make points with it, they really don't care who they put in the crosshairs to, you know, to go after it. And I think, you know, that was my point on this one is, you know, we have operated as IT professionals for a long, long time under the assumption of, you know, we're federal employees and, you know, things are relatively, I'd say protected, but protected from that standpoint. And to me, this one really said, yeah, you know, this is just another step along that trend. Now we're talking about an IT person who's got to come in and plead the fifth, not because, and I actually believe this, not because he did anything wrong. I mean, he stood up an email server. He did what he was told to do. He's got to plead the fifth because the political environment makes it such that if there is any hint of anything in there and he's said anything, he's subject to criminal prosecution. I would do exactly the same thing as he's doing, and I know nothing about this topic, but if they called me to testify on the topic, I'd plead the fifth for exactly that reason. It's the only way to protect yourself from the politics. And we in our profession are way too neophyte in the politics to ever get near it.
Tim, what I take away from what Roger states there is that it may not necessarily be a case of Mr. Brian Pagliano is his name, knowing something that will incriminate himself. It's the possibility that his testimony to the Committee on Benghazi could take him someplace that he doesn't even know about now, where he could incriminate himself. Do you think that's a fair read on my part?
Well, I don't really have a point of view on the political issue.
Sure.
I think the underlying significance of this topic is prudent around the importance of securing technology and having clarity to what is appropriate and inappropriate in terms of personal use while working. I think the other issue is around how do we recruit and retain top talent in the federal government when there are these types of examples Yes. of former federal executives or former federal staffers being treated this way by congressmen, congresswomen, right? I know, you know, during my tenure in the government, I was very proud of my public service, but if I had to endure this level of scrutiny, exposure, critique, particularly with social media at play, it would likely dissuade me from serving. And I think that is a toxic environment that we have to fix through our public officials.
Yeah, and let's go back to the geek chic discussion that that we just had. You know, you really want the federal government to be attractive to the digital entrepreneurs to come in and do things. But there are things that can make it a complete third rail, and the opportunity to land yourself in jail is one of those things. I think one of the most shocking things I found coming into the federal government the first time, because I had been only private sector for 20 years up to that, knew nothing about the government, was that my job description was a federal law and you could go to jail for violating it. Well, that's new. That's yep. That's not something that you deal with in the private sector.
I have a similar story. My first week at OMB, as a very young and frankly naive staffer in the White House, I received a piece of guidance from an alum of OMB, and he said, you should take out professional liability insurance. Yes. Because you don't know if you're going to get into a situation where you need to have representation outside of the government.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty scary proposition right there, particularly when you think about individuals who did nothing wrong or did what they were told to do, yet they are faced with potential litigation or investigation for doing their jobs. And I think that's very unfortunate for our public sector civil servants. And I think it speaks to a broader strategy that is needed to hold public servants, to include elected officials, accountable for how they provide oversight to the government.
Pagliano, who worked as a computer aide on Clinton's 2008 presidential campaign, helped manage her server at that time. When Clinton became Secretary of State, Pagliano got a job as a State Department IT staffer. He was also paid personally by the Clintons to continue managing the private server from 2009 to 2013. I cite that passage from the Washington Post article simply to cite that both in his capacity as an employee of the State Department and as an employee either personally of Secretary Clinton or the Clinton Foundation or whoever was the money behind the email server setup, he was an employee of somebody else and he was executing whatever service that employer wanted him to provide. And it speaks exactly, Roger, to what Tim was just talking about somebody who's just doing what he or she was told to do.
Yeah, well, let me start with a public service announcement.
Mm-hmm.
Federal employee liability insurance, don't leave home without it. I mean, really, if you are an employee of the federal government, you should have it. That's really what attracted me to this story. You know, you're doing your job. You know, you're doing your job the best way you know how. You know you haven't violated any laws, and all of a sudden, it's not the FBI that comes knocking, because you have a certain right of privacy and protection, you know, when it's the FBI that's knocking. It's a House committee. They're not known for their discretion or the temerity of, you know, their unwillingness to ask difficult questions. You know, they are going to scorch you if they can, and you can play the video of friends of mine that have been sitting in front of the committee, and all they do is try and scorch them. Watch a John Koskinen hearing sometime if you want to really see a lot of fun. And I'm not taking any political sides on this one, but if you want to see a complete lack of decorum in the way that a witness is handled, just watch a John Koskinen hearing at some point.
The most important federal news story of the week is selected by Roger Bakers from the Washington Post. The headline is "Lawmakers Require Ex-Clinton Staffer Who Worked on Email Server to Appear." And you can find that story and all of our stories on this week's countdown at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. When we come back, the most important federal news story of the week is selected by Tim Young on this week's Federal News Countdown. We'll be right back. This is the Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, and the experts choosing the most important federal news stories this week, Roger Baker and Tim Young. And Tim, your choice is the most important story of the week is from the Washington Post. The headline is "A New 9/11 Memorial to Flight 93. Our Loved Ones Left a Legacy for All of Us." And my colleague Tom Temin talked about this on the Federal Drive today. The story is very moving, and it's terrific that the Flight 93 Memorial is open in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. And I'm glad that you chose a story about 9/11, because in this business and speaking to the audience that I speak to all the time, I personally struggle every year with 9/11. about how to appropriately recognize it and remember it in a way that is meaningful and not superficial to my audience. And the reason that I say that is because I think being that we're a news source specifically for people who were so dramatically impacted by this event, it was, of course, historic for everybody that was around in 2001 and remembers it. But, I mean, as I mentioned during the break, I could name just off the top of my head five or six people who were dragging bodies around, living and dead, in the Pentagon in the aftermath of the crash there. What do I say to someone like that? And so my choice has probably not been the best one, but my choice over the years has been to say nothing and to let people's own remembrances of the day stand for itself, stand for themselves in the course of that time. And you suggested during the break that that might be a missed opportunity, and I appreciate that response, and I would encourage you to explain why you think that's the case.
So the reason that this issue more than any issue in current day is of significance is because it profoundly changed people's professional and personal lives and how, frankly, they view the government. And on a personal level, this was highly impactful for me. I was in the private sector on 9/11, 14 years ago. I was serving a federal agency client who happened to be located on this side of the Potomac. And we all heard about what happened with the World Trade Center, the first plane and the second plane. The first thing I did was I called my mom and I explained to her I was okay. I got her voicemail. And then I heard a loud screeching scream across the room. And it was one of my clients who was standing on the window looking at the Pentagon. And very, very emotional. And because of that event and the impact that had on the way in which I view the government, that was a big reason why I chose to serve and join the government. And when you think about that day, thoughts come to mind of hate and anger and revenge. But in my view, the more enduring message is one of resiliency and respect and reflection and remembrance in public service. And that's why, I think Roger served, that's why I served. And I think that highlights what the government is here to do, right? Which is serve the public, protect the public. And we don't talk about that enough, right? And today is a day for me of personal reflection to actually speak out about how the government impacts people's lives on so many dimensions in a very positive way. And we don't talk about that enough, in my view.
Roger?
I always think about the word valor, today, and I think this article brings that out. Valor in the civilians. Certainly, if you look inside, things that happened inside the World Trade Center, the valor there was incredible. This article, Flight 93, I was honored to work with Army folks, for 4 years that were there. And there in a way that, as you point out, far too far there for, for anybody's taste. And what you have to reflect on in this is those same individuals and the valor they showed are the same people that we just freely criticize and wantonly criticize for other things. And I could use a lot of invectives for some of the criticism that people of incredible valor that I worked with took. One most notably, maybe the most heroic person that that we've all had the opportunity to serve with in General Rick Shinseki. And yet you look at what the political realm does, and I think it's a good day to remember that they're all human beings, we're all human beings. The folks that show the valor are showing valor in everything they do. They don't show up to work and say, well, I'm going to be this way if this happens, but another way at another point in time. And they need that level of credit. We work with those folks every day. They're around us everywhere. And we need to recognize what they're doing for us all the time. Not just when they happen to do something outstanding or when something doesn't go the way they'd like it to go. It's a good day to reflect.
One more government connection here, that the Flight 93 Memorial in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, will be administered by the National Park Service, and so that becomes another chain in the jewel of the United States that a lot of people consider the NPS to be. I grew up near the battlefield in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and I continue to marvel at the work that the National Park Service does to maintain that site and other sites around the country. Thank you very much, both of you, for helping me to understand how to better treat 9/11. Tim Young, most important federal news story of the week from the Washington Post, the new 9/11 memorial to Flight 93. Our loved ones left a legacy for all of us. Tim, thank you for being on. Roger, it's great to see you again. And thank you. The Federal News Countdown is archived at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, and it's back next Friday.